Throughout the state's history, North Carolina has moved through waves of racial, social, and economic progress, and other times has taken a few steps backward. So where are we now? That's a question two North Carolina policy experts have been thinking deeply about. James Lutis is a history professor at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. He's also the co-author of To Right These Wrongs, The North Carolina Fund and the Battle to End Poverty and Inequality in 1960s America. Verla Insko is a Democratic representative from Orange County in the North Carolina General Assembly. And this Saturday, they will take a deep dive into the history of North Carolina politics and policies to uncover patterns and perhaps set a course for the future. The panel discussion is hosted by Carolina Public Humanities at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. And we're going to get a preview right now. Verla Insko and Jim Lalutis, welcome to the State of Things. Good to have you here.
Thank you, Frank.
Always great to be here.
It's good to have you. So let's talk about this and maybe take us back. I mean, give us a scope, right? I mean, if we go back to, let's say, to the 1860s and take a panoramic view. Give us a sense of North Carolina through time.
Yeah, sure. Well, thanks, Frank. You know, as a historian, that's where I'm inclined to go first, is sort of the long view. And as a historian looking at politics in North Carolina today, politics in the nation, I can't help but feel like I've seen this movie before. You know, the characters are different. The staging has been updated. But the plot line is in some ways very, very familiar. And it goes like this. I mean, you talked about cycles in the state's political history. The cycle tends to start with an expansion of participatory democracy, freer and fairer access to the franchise, the election of lawmakers who are more representative of the demography of the state, and lawmakers who in turn are responsive to their constituents in terms of increased public investment in social provision, things like schooling and housing and health care and so on. And that is, in this cycle, pretty quickly the response comes a pretty concerted effort to push back on those changes, to do so in ways that preserves and protects local and private power and wealth. And unfortunately, much of that effort historically, you know, we've seen it in the past and in our own time driven often by a politics of racial divisiveness and resentment.
Maybe the best example, and again, in broad strokes, we can take the period after the end of slavery. It opens up possibilities for other parts of the population that had been cut out of the process. And then it takes us through to, say, 1898 to pick two points or spans on that timeline. Give us a sense of sort of how things expanded and then contracted in that moment.
Yeah, well, historians tend to sometimes cut up into smaller pieces the late 19th century. But, you know, the way I would describe it is a long race war that roiled this state from the end of the Civil War and emancipation through the white supremacy campaigns of the late 1890s. I mean, we open in Reconstruction with a quite remarkable biracial alliance that comes to power, that writes into the state constitution the guarantee of the right to vote for every adult male, and for the first time in this state's history, mandates a system of public education. But by the end of the century, particularly after the white supremacy campaigns of 1898 and 1900, much of that is rolled back. I mean, that long racial war ends with the disfranchisement of black men and the establishment of the regime of Jim Crow. And while history doesn't repeat itself, it echoes. And I think it's fair to say that in some respects we are living in an echo.
Well, Verla Insko, you have to live with that on a day-to-day basis. You don't have in the North Carolina legislature nearly the span that Jim can work with. Sometimes you have a matter of hours to to consider important legislation. But what about that? I mean, central to what Jim is saying is that the battle for white supremacy, for that concept to take hold, has always relied on division, particularly dividing poor whites and African Americans. We saw this writ large in 1898. How do you see, I mean, is that, history doesn't repeat itself, but do you see elements of that today playing out in the work that you do?
Oh, of course, yes. So in North Carolina, of course, at the turn of the century, everyone was registered a Democrat because of Jim Crow. And so that actually persisted for a good many years. I think it was actually 1965 before Republicans gained more than 20 seats in the General Assembly. Until then, they were 14 seats, 8 seats, year after year. And so it's really, and I think there was so the Democratic Party was made up of conservative Democrats, moderate Democrats, and liberal Democrats. And the decisions were made in the primary. And the governor, the Democratic governor that came in, took over the party. There didn't need to be a strong Democratic Party. And meanwhile, when we first moved here in 1965, the Republicans we knew were Quaker. And there's been a huge shift since then. But I think the advances that we made in the 60s were continued for some time. But it was actually in that period in the mid 60s when the shift started back. Which is interesting at the national level.
Shift started back in which direction?
Toward a more conservative direction.
Yeah, we have to keep in mind the Democratic Party is the party of white supremacy for the first half of the 20th century and a little beyond. Jim, give me kind of in broad strokes that struggle that Verla talks about, the sort of the conservative, moderate, and liberals within the Democratic Party. It certainly, as we say, was the party of white supremacy. So it would seem that conservatives had control for most of that period?
Well, they did through most of the early 20th century, really, into the 60s and 70s. Things began to change in a big way. I mean, well, you could look at 1968 and Richard Nixon's Southern strategy. Mm-hmm. The National Party had been changing quite profoundly since the 1930s. If you look at Roosevelt's coalition, it was liberal whites in the Northeast. It was unionized working people. And African-American voters outside the South. But the party inside the South was the party of white supremacy. And by the time we get to the civil rights movement of the 1960s, increasingly the Democratic Party nationally is the party of civil rights. And that kind of contradiction just won't hold anymore. And as the National Party moved in that direction, and the State Department, the party to some degree as well, there is a profound realignment. And probably Ronald Reagan's election in some ways might be the final tipping point. I suppose what I'd say there in broad terms is that, the civil rights movement toppled Jim Crow, but white supremacy wasn't vanquished.
Interestingly enough, though, right here in the state of North Carolina, you have one of the most stark divisions among Southern Democrats that you can possibly see. Talk about the speeches 1 week apart. George Wallace talking about his infamous segregation now and forever. And then North Carolina's Terry Sanford a week later.
Yeah, I think the speech is so important, and I always want my students to hear it because it reminds us of the terrible price of Jim Crow, obviously for black North Carolinians, but also for vast numbers of white North Carolinians as well. I mean, Jim Crow wasn't just a set of bad manners and bad prejudiced attitudes. It was a system of power that certainly subjugated black people in the process, diminished the value of all labor, and so impoverished many white people as well. Of course, also encourage them not to challenge that, lest they lose sort of what Du Bois called the wages of whiteness, the privileges of white skin. Yeah, I think you've got a
I do. Yeah, this is Terry Sanford. This is January 1963. This is the governor of the state of North Carolina.
On the 100th anniversary of emancipation.
On the 100th anniversary of emancipation, and 1 week after George Wallace infamously promised that segregation would never end in the South, here is the governor of North Carolina.
The Negro's opportunity to obtain a good job has not been achieved in most places across the nation. Reluctance to accept the Negro in employment is the greatest single block to his continued progress and to the full use of this human potential of the nation and its states. The time has come for American citizens to give up this reluctance and to quit unfair discrimination, and to give the Negro a full chance to earn a decent living for his family and to contribute to higher standards for himself and for all men.
That was Terry Sanford, who was governor of North Carolina in 1963 when he gave that speech. How was he able to give that speech in this state, Jim?
Well, that's a really good question. you know, it's a great example of remarkably bold leadership, I'd say even visionary leadership. In some ways, I think Sanford could give that because the governor of North Carolina could not be reelected for a second term at that point. It was unconstitutional. And so he could sort of step way out on a limb. What's remarkable about this speech as he goes on is that he comes to those points I was talking about just a minute ago, and he says point blank, we will never create what he called a new day in North Carolina. We will never create prosperity for all North Carolinians until we first liberate black North Carolinians from Jim Crow. As you say, that's a week after George Wallace declares segregation today, tomorrow, and forever. It's a speech I think we do well to come back to and listen to and contemplate today.
Verla Inscrow, as a Democrat in the North Carolina legislature and therefore a member of a minority party, the minority party, does this mean, does the victory of Republicans mean that this, that the message, that that particular message is lost forever, that this is what the state of North Carolina is saying to us, we don't want to be sort of in that camp anymore, given some of the legislation on voting rights and on gay rights that we've seen in this state?
Well, it's interesting. I'm not a historian, but I actually see things a little bit differently. I believe that we've had visionary leadership emerge in North Carolina at different periods. In 1913, Harriet Moorhead Berry went around the state and convinced the state to have a state highway system. In 1933, our state legislature raised taxes during the Depression to fund schools because they wanted to keep the schools open. So in the emergence of the Research Triangle Park was done by conservative business people because they saw the economy was changing. They wanted the economy to shift from tobacco, textiles, and furniture to science and I think those were probably.
But that now it's 2017, and you started at a time when the Republicans had taken control of the legislature for the first time in nearly 100 years, and you were a minority party member then. But things were different for you then, were they not, in terms of your relationship with the Republican Party?
Yeah, yes, but the Republican Party in 1965 was not unlike what I've been describing, the Archie Davises from the Research Triangle Park. And actually, those Democrats who were – the Republicans who were in charge then, actually, they supported the merit selection of nonpartisan judges, for example. Their big issue was local control. They did not like the state putting mandates on local government. It has changed very much. They actually increased funding for Smart Start, supported Jim Hunt's Smart Start.
That was a Democratic governor that they
supported.
And
they passed a reduced income taxes. Leo Daughtry, who's now on the Board of Governors and is criticizing the position the Board of Governors has just taken, ran a bill then to reduce the income tax for low-income people. They opposed the sales tax on food. And so they actually reduced – Terry Sanford, of course, was a person that took the sales tax up on the exemption on taxes on food. And we actually – Democrats increased it to 5%. Well, when Republicans got in the majority, they reduced the tax on food. Mm-hmm. So they were a very different brand than what we have.
Do you think it's going to swing back? Would anything bring it back? Or are we sort of headed off into space and trajectory here?
It will. It'll depend. It was. I think I mentioned in the strategy, I think, has changed that there's been an agreement among more conservative Republicans about how to use control. And it was 1995. I'm skipping ahead a little bit, but just the year that they had control for the first time in 100 years about. John Davis, a Republican strategist, wrote the report How North Carolina Republican Party Can Maintain Political Power for 114 Years. His rule number 5 was lose the courts, lose the war.
Verla Inscrow, Democratic representative of the North Carolina General Assembly. Jim Lilitis is a history professor at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. They're going to be part of a conversation, North Carolina Politics Then and Now. That's going to be in Research Triangle Park on Saturday, and we have all the information at our website, stateofthings.org. Thank you both for being on the program.
Thank you very much.
Coming up, we're going to preview the National Folk Festival that gets started this weekend in Greensboro. Stay with us.